This week.
Pardon me. No,
you're a mess.
I'm getting over my mess.
Well, okay, fine. I'm more in the middle of it, but we're both phlegmy Martin this week.
You're fighting off a cold.
Yes.
You've got it.
I've got one.
You have a cold. And
everybody got sick during Outfest. I managed to hold out and get sick after Outfest.
Right.
And you had a sinus infection, so
I had a sinus infection.
We're just a million laughs this week.
And then do we want to talk about the thing that happened to me?
Do you?
Sure.
All right.
I must have coughed a lot during the sinus infection. Because somehow I pulled a muscle in my chest or something. My strapping masculine super chest.
You pulled your moob.
Yeah. And I wound up with chest pains. That were pretty, I mean, they weren't good.
They woke you up.
They woke me up in the middle of the night on Friday night. And you know, it's 3 a.m. and I'm lying in bed with chest pain thinking, I have chest pain and it is hurting me in the back and now it's shooting down my arm. And I'm 48 years old and fat. Could it be that there's something happening to me right now? Could this be the thing that every fat middle-aged man dreads? Could that be happening? So I get up and I go to WebMD. My name is Dave White, by the way. I'm the film critic for movies.com.
And I'm Alonzo Duraldi, film critic for therap.com and What the Flick.
I get up and I get on the internet. That's my first mistake.
Yes.
My second mistake is going to WebMD.
Oh yeah. Because you're always dying on WebMD. I think that's their actual motto.
You're forever dying on WebMD. You're going to keep dying even after you're dead on WebMD.
Everything's a tumor.
And here's what WebMD told me. Call 911. I was like, no, that's dumb. This is maybe I don't know what this is. I don't remember lifting anything weirdly or wrongly. It didn't feel squeezy, and it didn't. I wasn't sweaty. There was no nausea. I was short of breath. I wasn't numb. But I had chest pain, and it said some heart attacks begin with mild chest pain and can last for hours, even days, before people realize what's happening to them. And I was like, all right, so I wake you up, and we go to the emergency room. I haven't put this on Facebook at all.
No, I'm surprised you're telling it now.
I've told a handful of friends.
I thought this was going to be all.
You know what? I didn't want to. Anything you put on Facebook. Here's the problem with Facebook.
Hugs.
First of all, hugs with a Z. Secondly, awe.
Yeah.
Thirdly, oh man, I'm so happy you're okay. Well, there was nothing wrong with me in the first place. So there's nothing to be okay from.
Spoiler.
Yeah.
Weren't having a heart attack.
I was not having a heart attack, it turns out. But I didn't learn that for hours because, you know, you get to the ER and they start treating you like you're having a heart attack. So, you know, they give me nitroglycerin, which was kind of cool because I felt like I might explode.
You were the human bomb.
I was a human bomb. And then and then they took my blood like three times and tested my blood three times for evidence of. There are special heart attack enzymes. I didn't know this. But there are. And,
the upshot of all this is we know that your heart's in good shape.
My heart's amazing.
Because they checked it like all get out.
My heart will go on and on and on.
Thank you, Saleem.
Whether you want it to or not. This is what's so great about currently being me and being as fat as I am. First of all, I look really cute. Secondly, my numbers are fantastic. The nurse at the end of my 9-hour stay in the ER said, well, you do have high cholesterol. I go, no, I don't. And she looks again. She goes, oh, yeah, this number's from 2005, and you were only over a little bit. I said, and then I corrected it with oatmeal.
So there.
So I'm full of raw fruits and vegetables all the time. Too many of them, which I don't exercise off fast enough. Hence my adorable fatness. My heart's in great shape.
You love fruit so much that you are pear-shaped.
Yeah, I'm not pear-shaped. I'm apple. No, I learned this. I'm not pear-shaped. I'm apple-shaped.
Ah, okay.
Got yeah. You. So the...
Oh, that's true. Pear-shaped is a whole other thing.
Yeah, pear-shaped would be if I were hippie.
Right.
If I had big hips, right. A big booty, and a weird... That
fat apron?
That grimacy fat apron yeah. that you see sometimes. Yeah. Which, fine. If you've got a fat apron, I don't have a problem with that. I think you're lovely.
We don't judge.
Yeah. I'm just apples.
You're apples.
But the, so anyway, where was I? Did not have a heart attack, it turns out.
That was a good news.
I still have this chest, it still hurts. Mm-hmm. Like the third doctor that I spoke to, the shift changed three times mm-hmm. or something in the course. Third doctor that I talked to came in and said, does this hurt? And he shoved his fingers into my chest.
Ah.
And I go, ow. And he goes, it's not a heart attack. He goes, that's your pectoral muscles. He goes, if I had done that, you know, to your heart, you wouldn't have gone, ow. That's not how it works. So, but he jabbed me with his fingers. Like the other people, you were there for the other two
right.
doctors. The other two guys came in and were like pressing down kind of gently. Like I think they were afraid I was going to blow up or something. And this guy came in and it was almost like he was doing the, am I bugging you? 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 Like that kind of thing. But he jabbed his fingers into my chest. And he was like, does that hurt? I was like, yes, it does. Get away from me. I just woke up from a little nap on the gurney you put me on. By the way, the first gown they gave me, I know we're going to talk about the movies in a minute. The first gown they gave me.
It was a petite.
They put you in the gown. They put me in a gown for Kristen Chenoweth. Like, they put me in, like, whatever the doll-sized gown is in the hospital. Like, they couldn't even get my tubes. Like, they hooked me up to all these tubes to monitor me. They couldn't even move the tubes under the tightness of this gown. Then they go, let's get you a bigger gown. And you never saw this other gown.
No, I saw it.
No, I sent you home.
No, I was there for the second gown.
Oh, okay.
The one that said potatoes on the side.
After, you know, because I was bored, I would sleep and then I would wake up. Now, eventually I did send you home to go to sleep. After they determined that
you were not, in fact,
that I was not having a heart attack, but they wanted to keep me
for observation
to keep looking at me. I sent you home to mm-hmm. go back to sleep.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get bored, you start puttering around the room. You know? And I finally found the tag of the gown that they gave me. Did you know this gown that it was like a giant Alan Carr caftan.
Like, it's like that episode of...
Like, I felt like I should be... I felt like Sylvester. Like, it was like that singing, You Make Me Feel Mighty
that,
Real.
That episode of The Simpsons where Homer becomes, like, so morbidly obese that he can't go to work anymore and he wears that big moo-moo thing.
This thing... Do you know what size this thing was?
Do tell.
10X.
Whoa.
10! It was 10X. It was crazy. Like, the neck of this thing made me look like I was wearing a giant, like, scoop cleavage dress. Like you could see pretty much everything
So basically, the hospital gowns come in...
Except my nipples.
...come in Kristen Chenoweth and William the Refrigerator Perry, but nothing in between.
No, not William the Refrigerator Perry. Like, whatever the
refrigerator... Johnson.
Whatever the refrigerator that William the Refrigerator Perry climbed into, and then the box that they put over that refrigerator, and then the coffin that you get buried in inside that box. And the, like, it was out of... I was like, who? And I was... Because they just threw it at me. They weren't checking inside. Who really needs the 10X? Like, I want to see the person.
They're out there.
I know they're out there, or there wouldn't be the 10X.
They're often shown on local news with their heads cut out of the shot every time they do an article about an item about obesity.
It's crazy.
They find those people walking around, and they cut their heads off. And they're
I'm standing there in it, and I'm thinking, I want to see the person who really fits into this. Like, I want to stand next to them, you know. I mean, because I have some friends who are pretty fat, like fatter than me, way even like they're we have people in our lives who are two of us, you know. But
even they, would even find they that would roomy.
Even they would be roomy in the 10X. So I did not have a heart attack. I came home. I putted around yesterday. Didn't do a whole lot. Because I'd only had about 4 hours of sleep, and then that weird sleep that you have in the gurney,
where you're on your back
and you're all covered in wires, and they've attached all the wires to you.
Yeah,
hurts when they take those little pads.
Oh, I bet. By the way, I was not there for that.
Any amount of hair on your body,
rip.
Maybe women don't experience this, but
women get waxed, so they experience it way worse.
Yeah, I guess they do.
Those that do, anyway.
But, it doesn't feel nice when they rip all that stuff off of you.
I'm sure not.
Where was I going? What was I about to say?
I have no idea.
I don't know what... Oh, because we were coughing. We both coughed at the beginning, and we began talking about our ailments.
Oh, right, yes.
Yes.
None of which were helped by not getting any sleep on Friday
night. I had a crazy Xanax dream while I was, in the ER.
Don't share that.
Because I had taken an ER, I had taken a Xanax, because I'm flying to Texas in a week, so it's Xanax time. Mm-hmm. And a crazy Xanax dream about a cat that was eating my finger. A cat was eating my finger. And when I said to the cat, hey, don't eat my finger, cat, it said, someone has to feed me. They don't feed me here. It was a bookstore cat.
And it was fat, right?
It was a fat cat in a bookstore.
Well, the last time you went to an emergency
was because of a cat. A cat put me in the ER the last time I was in the ER because I'm allergic. I'm extremely...
You're that allergic.
I'm not just aesthetically allergic to cats. I know there are people out there who use the word allergy as a fakey thing. Like, I just don't like it. You know, like, and they say they're allergic to it. A cat can kill me. Like, getting too close to a cat, touching a cat, can make me die.
Your head blew up. I saw photos.
My head blew up like a crazy, like, giant tomato.
Yeah.
And so this cat took my finger in its paws and started eating my finger. And I said, hey, quit eating my finger. And the cat started talking to me and said, please feed me. I'm sorry, I'm trying to eat your finger. Will you please go get me some cat food? But then I went to the grocery store and they didn't have cat food. I was trying to find the cat food for the cat. And the cat, I can hear the cat in the back going, feed me. What is that even? What does a dream like that mean?
Your dreams are ridiculous.
And
your Xanax dreams are crazy.
My Xanax dreams are crazy. Movies.
Yes.
Everything we've just discussed is more exciting and pleasurable than The Watch.
Yes.
Let's just get that out of the way.
Fine.
We're here to discuss the current cinema.
Yes.
And, as they say in The New Yorker,
By the way, ask me later why I picked that theme music. It's a topic I want
to. No, go back. Yeah. I'm sorry. Before we start talking about The Watch,
okay.
Y'all don't care if we get to The Watch. You know you don't care if we talk about The Watch. Tell me, why did you choose the theme music? Who was that?
That was Dave Perner.
Of Soul Asylum and Winona Ryder fame.
Exactly.
Okay.
That was a song called, a cut called Tube of Wonderful. It was...
From a movie.
Yeah, it's the theme music to Chasing Amy.
Is it?
Yes.
Oh.
And I popped it in because Kevin Smith is really bugging me lately.
What did he do now?
No, it's this he's on this.
Does he do? Has he done anything since Comic-Con?
No, but we haven't. Well, then we haven't talked about it yet.
We have.
No, not
we
on,
have talked no, about no, this.
Not on the show.
Yes, we have.
No, we haven't.
You're being forgetful.
We have not talked about this on the show.
Yes, we have.
No, when?
Indeed, we have. We have recently discussed Kevin Smith's antipathy toward film critics.
I think we've discussed it in our lives, but not on this program.
On the show, we've talked about it. Are you still complaining? Are you still? Are you widow feelings?
No, it's not my widow feelings. I didn't think we'd talked about it on the show yet.
We have.
All right, listeners.
Not as a thing. Not as a huge thing, but as,
write in and tell me if Dave is gaslighting me or not.
No, we did. We mentioned this. Linoleum it wasn't like a giant topic of conversation, but we did talk about it.
All right. Okay, then I'll drop it. Fine. It's just still bugging me.
Listen. All right. Let's just here. I'm going to tell you some wisdom.
Oh, okay.
Are you ready? I'm going to lay it down for you. Mm. Are you? Can you handle it?
I am ready for your wisdom.
Let it go. Here's why. I'm going to give you some reason now.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, he can say whatever he wants about film critics. Secondly, if he's going to get honest and real with himself, and eventually he will, because he is, in general, an honest and real guy.
Yes.
That's why you and I have been such fans of his over the years.
Yes.
And eventually, he's gonna burn through this anger that's driving him right now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is exactly, but something's driving him right now to make him lash out at film critics. And the idea of criticism as a thing that should or should not exist.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll understand that everything that is related to film, the making of it, the writing of it, the creating of it, the promoting it, the writing about it, is all part of the same pool. You know, it's all part of the same ocean of stuff that's related to movies.
Mm-hmm.
And if it weren't, he would not have a movie review show right now. And hang on, I'm going to cough now.
Yeah, but the point of that
hang
show...
Hang on, I'm still giving you wisdom. I know what the point of that show is. The point of that show is a generalized anti-intellectualism, which is also kind of the point of this show, but... It is just one more voice, and he's got a big platform because the people who are his fans, including you and me, are part of that audience, including one of our friends who happens to be on that show.
Okay. I see. That didn't last.
That didn't last?
we're talking so anyway. About... Anyway.
And so, I didn't know that. Anyway.
But only because he decided that it was time to like, cut bait and make his own opportunities.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I don't know anything about that. Okay. We don't need to... In fact, that probably needs to be...
No. He discusses this... we're talking about Malcolm Ingram, and he talks... And I was going to mention later in the show that, you know, Blowhard is a show I always recommend.
Yes.
He just taped his last one.
Yes.
And it's his last one for the Smodcast network, for sure.
Yes,
And he talks about that basically he...
On this episode?
On this new episode?
Okay, I haven't heard it yet.
Yeah, so this, I'm not telling tales out of school.
All right.
He talks about how he owes his career up till now to Kevin, but that he needs to make it on his own,
great.
And you know, so that's why he parted ways with Spoilers, and he's now going to be doing a new podcast that Film Threat is going to carry.
Okay, great. Well, that's awesome. That's wonderful.
Yeah, no, good for him.
You, on the other hand, need to calm down and stop taking it personally, because that's what you're doing, and so it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. There's a whole world of people out there who write and think about movies, and now he's a part of it, and it's a double-edged sort of like sword that he's wielding right now with it, and that's fine.
I just feel like that film critics are becoming such an endangered species at this point.
It doesn't matter
that the last thing we need is more dumping on us.
No, we need him, because what he does is he provides an opportunity for people to keep talking about this idea.
Perhaps.
And and eventually the idea that writing and talking about film is valuable, and it's valuable for film, not just for the people who do it for a living.
Right.
It's valuable for film. It's valuable for film fans. It's valuable for audiences.
And not just as a consumer advocacy thing, but as a way to talk about art.
So go spoilers. And go Kevin Smith. I'm still pro him. I'm not offended by any of this. You should not be either.
Mm.
There. I have become super wise guy for you.
You are not the boss of
me. What I'd really like to talk about is this song that happens before the Dave Perner song. There's a song on this tape.
I can't believe we're having a musical.
I have never heard this song before.
I put it on a mix 11 years ago.
2001 is what it says on this tape.
So not my fault.
Suddenly, whatever the hell song that is now my jam. And I'm looking at it. You were queuing it up. And I was like, who's?
Because it's the song before the Dave Perner song.
It's by some people called Shorty 101.
It is from the soundtrack of the Tommy O'Haver.
Shorty 101.
From the Tommy O'Haver.
Shorty comedy. Fire burning on the dance floor. Yes. 101.
It's from the soundtrack of Get Over It, that movie with
nobody saw.
Ben Foster and Kirsten Dunst. Yes. That nobody saw, but that is actually pretty funny and it's a really good soundtrack. I discovered Badly Drawn Boy from that album.
Shorty 101, Get With Me? Is that what it's called?
Who are Shorty 101?
I don't know.
I thought you were looking them up before the show.
Well, I can't finally find anything about them. Other than there's a YouTube video. And,
you know, they were clearly not Destiny's Child.
They basically didn't become famous. Shorty 101. I love their name, though.
Fame eluded a Shorty 101.
I'm keeping this cassette out for the next dish-doing adventure.
Okay, fine.
So I can listen to Shorty 101's Get With Me. Because summer ain't over yet.
I have a
2012 summer jam is from 2011. I saw
2001.
I saw 2001. I saw Get Over It. I don't remember this song being in the movie.
It's in there somewhere for like 5 seconds probably. You know how movies are with soundtracks. Dave has this great compilation of like 60s girl groups that did not become famous.
Right.
And the liner notes are all like, fame eluded, you know, the Daisies 3 or whatever. Right, you know, it's pretty funny.
It's called You Can Be Wrong About Boys.
Yes. And it's got some good songs.
That's the name of the compilation.
That's right.
And you can be.
I mean, totally.
You're wrong about Kevin Smith, by the way.
Oh, whatever.
Yeah, you are.
I can be wrong about boys if I want to.
Remember, here's what you do. Here's my homework for you.
Remember the good times?
Regarding Kevin Smith. Remember the good times. Be nice to Kevin Smith. He needs people to be nice to him right now.
Oh, please.
Because, listen, because Southwest Airlines was not nice to him.
Yes, I know. And we're all paying for
it. And after that, lots and lots of other people were not nice to him because they felt like they had sudden license. So
look,
so we're done. We're done talking. We're done talking about it.
I was in the 6% of people who gave a fresh review to Cop Out. So shush.
I liked Cop Out too. I'm not backing down on that.
I'm not either.
Cop Out made me laugh.
I made too. They used the Fletch theme. I was all about it. And I would rather watch Cop Out again than
The Watch. Please discuss The Watch, Alonzo. Brother.
Well, it was called Neighborhood Watch. And then they had to change it because, you know, the thing. So basically, Ben Stiller is in a small town in Ohio, and he's not Leslie Knope,
right,
but he might as well
be. He behaves kind of like Amy Poehler on Parks and Rec.
He's a booster. He starts clubs, you know, and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he manages the local Costco. And it's Costco. They call it Costco. It's not like Costco didn't let them use the name Costco.
Costco's super excited to be
Costco is in this movie because they say Costco a million times.
Right.
So Costco, Costco, Costco. One night, the night watchman at Costco is horribly murdered. And the local cops are doofuses. And so Ben Stiller decides to put together a neighborhood watch to try and catch the killer and, like, fight crime in general. And the only people who show up are Vince Vaughn as a sort of married, you know, dad bro guy who's looking for some male bonding. Jonah Hill, who is the kind of guy who failed the psych exam to get onto the local police force.
And has sort of a vague, unspecified rage.
Yeah.
We don't know what it's about.
Guns under the bed. He's kind of...
lives with his mom. He's resentful.
Kind of Unabomber-ish, that. You know. And then and Richard Ayoade from the IT Crowd and who directed Submarine as this sort of dorky divorcee. And...
but who's cool and mysterious in a way.
Sort of.
We don't know anything about him. I mean, they don't tell you anything about it.
Right, but he, you know, he's basically, he's like, he's
later on, they tell you stuff about
him. Yeah, he's sort of newly divorced and just kind of, you know, kind of a dork in the way that Richard Ayoade always plays.
Yeah.
And, you know, not very funny shenanigans ensue that wind up involving aliens that have shown up. And,
Here's me watching this movie.
Yeah, I think I counted two and one. Yeah,
right.
It's
about every 20 minutes.
Yeah, painfully not funny, this movie. And the thing is,
the woman who tweeted at you and said, but the commercial seems so funny.
To which I responded, and when have TV commercials ever led you astray? Right. And she responded, touche.
She responded positively.
She did. She was game. So good for her.
Yeah.
This movie is just, and it's what's so depressing about it is that it's got all these really funny people involved in it. I mean, the four leads have been funny in movies. It was written by one of the Saturday Night Live writers, and then rewritten or whatever by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg.
Yep.
It's directed by Akiva Schaffer, who directed Hot Rod the Movie. Which we loved. Which, if you haven't seen, seriously, see Hot Rod the movie.
See Hot Rod.
It's hilarious.
It's weeding Hot Rod.
You know, if you're a fan of Andy Samberg, if you like the Lonely Island stuff, you know, Schaefer is one of the Lonely Island guys.
Right.
You know, he directed a ton of those.
And they all have a cameo.
Yes, they do in this movie. Yeah. But this movie, you can just tell along the way that somebody thought somebody else was going to make this work. Like, you know, the writers were like, we'll give them a framework and they'll get on the set and magic will happen, you know. And it never does.
Or else somebody hacked it up.
I don't know what's wrong with this movie, but wrong it is.
There's something, somebody made a mistake, a big mistake, and then they made it for the entire running length of the film.
Yeah.
Like, it's, I don't understand how movies like this happen. Because you've got on paper, you've got everybody, and I'm going to even include Ben Stiller in there, even though he drives me crazy most of the time.
But he's capable.
But he can do it.
When he feels like it. It was like watching Friends with Kids, where it's like, this looks like it's supposed to be funny.
Right. Look at all those bridesmaids people.
Yeah, I'm watching this thing, and there's a plot that has potentially funny stuff in it, you know, the kids or the aliens or whatever, you know, the thing. But it's just not ever funny, like, you know, and that's what's happening in this movie. It's painful.
I don't understand... at what point do the people responsible say, okay, we're just going to release it anyway. We're going to put this out and we don't really care anymore.
We have enough, there's enough funny stuff for a trailer.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah.
Here's the other thing that baffles me. Attack the Block came out last summer, a year ago. God. Attack the Block came out a year ago. I guarantee you every person involved in that film saw Attack the Block. Attack the Block was not a big hit, but folks that we know saw it. And that means creative people saw it too.
Right, right.
And so that movie has the same plot.
Yeah.
More or less. It's the same plot. And how you make a tiny little low-budget indie seem fresh and alive and funny and exciting, and then do the same thing with a budget of $70 million and turn out this inert,
bloated,
lifeless thing.
Nothing.
Where even the aliens
aren't.
They look like the aliens from Zat.
From what?
There's another title too. MST did it.
The Bloodwaters of Dr. Z?
Yes. Yeah.
I was thinking Predator, but okay.
Yeah.
Without the dreadlocks.
No, they don't look awesome like Predator. Mm. They're not even like fully compelling aliens. They don't even, they're not, there's no, you don't feel threatened by them.
No.
On any level.
You know, and then the joke becomes they finally figure out the alien's weakness is that you shoot them in the groin.
Right. God. Gotta shoot them in the D.
I wanted to shoot me in the D just to get out of the theater.
It was very cold in the D for me in that theater. And so I am sad, honestly, about this. You know, I like a comedy from people I like, and all of these people are people I like. I even like Vince Vaughn.
I know
that's not popular to say.
And he's made a lot of crappy movies, but he can be funny when he feels like it.
Yeah, and so I just, you know, it bums me out when I have to, you know, because of it being my job and all, it bums me out to have to say, yeah, this is not something you want to go near. I mean, like, you'll see it on cable in a year, and you'll see it while you're paying the bill. Like, you'll be paying the bills
right at
the dining room table and looking over into the living room to look at it and be like, well, it's on while I'm paying the bills. That part was somewhat amusing. Like, Richard Ayoade, or however you say his last name?
I think it's Ayoade. I think.
Difference of pronunciation. He, you can feel him trying to be, you know, like I actually, this was like his first big movie in the United States.
Yes.
And I feel kind of bummed out for him.
I know.
That this is such a stinky one.
I know, especially because his co-star on the IT Crowd,
Chris O'Dowd. It's
Chris O'Dowd from Bridesmaids. You know, he lucked out on his first.
Yeah, if you got Netflix streaming, is the IT Crowd still on Netflix streaming?
I think they took it down, unfortunately. Actually, I take it back. Chris O'Dowd before Bridesmaids was in Gulliver's Travels. So maybe.
Oh, that's right, he was.
Maybe this is how they jump you in the United States. You have to do a crappy, expensive 20th Century Fox, like special effects heavy, stupid comedy.
This was the screening where the.
Just like Three Stooges, where they surrounded us with...
No, that's not where I was going.
Oh, regular
people. They did surround us with regular folks, but that was not the point. This is a screening where the security guy... There was some snafu at the entrance to the lot.
Right.
Because we saw it on the Fox lot. There was some kind of weird snafu where they were like the wrong... Like, the regular folks had to go in a different entrance or something.
Not that they bothered to explain any of this to the press.
People, no, they were turning people away at the gate. And the light and the line to get into the gate wrapped all the way out to Avenue of the Stars.
Right.
And the line of cars. And when I got up, they were just turning cars around. And I finally was like, what's happening? And the guard came up to me and he's like, are you here for the screening? I said, yes, with a watch. And he goes, okay, you have to go in the other. I go, but I'm press. Because that's always the first thing out of my mouth. I'm press.
Yeah.
Like, don't do me.
Don't throw me in with the radio.
I'm press. And he goes, where's your press badge? And I was like.
Scoop Brady.
Yeah, no. And as I said on Facebook, sure, let me pull that out of my fedora for you. Here was the weird thing about this guy. He wasn't angry or mean or anything. He wasn't being a jerk. He was just like, where's your press badge? Like. Please present your press badge. And
a thing I've seen many times in my career as a security guard.
I figured him to be about 24 years old.
Mm-hmm.
We have a 24-year-old friend in our life to whom I recently explained the concept of 8-track tapes. Who he had never seen nor heard of 8-track tapes before.
Or I remember I had to walk him through what ACT UP was.
Well, yeah, okay, so anyway, he's young.
Yes.
And no crime in not knowing what an 8-track tape was. You're born in 1989. You're not going to know what an 8-track tape is. And
but where do you get press badge?
But where do you get press badge from? Like, have you ever seen one in real life?
Do you watch a lot of TCM?
Do you watch a lot of old movies? You know, like, you're a big His Girl Friday fan?
Like, I mean, they do exist. Like, people who, you know, cover murders and fires have them. But, I mean, film critics don't.
Right.
press badge.
It just was really funny. Like,
get me Smitty on the copy desk.
Of all the things that you would know about versus not knowing about.
Right, right.
You know. And your whole job is like letting movie critics into a studio lot. It's there's not a press
badge. Yeah, I don't think in the orientation they were like, make sure you ask for a press badge.
I go, there's no such thing. And he looks at me and I go, there's no such thing. I go, I get invited via email. I write for the internet. And that is what happens. Yeah. But it was easy. He goes, oh, okay, just go right on in. And I was like,
thank you.
Why did you even bother asking me for my press badge if all I had to say was no?
Like, you passed the test.
Were you ready for that? Like, I will not. I have one, but you can't look at it. Fine. Go right into the studio.
These are not the droids you're looking for.
Sheesh. So, but he was not, he was, you know, he was a perfectly nice dude. He wasn't grumpy or overbearing or difficult. Actually, when I'm going on to the Fox lot, I never get cranky security.
No, they're fine.
The only time I ever get cranky people are the goons that screening that studios will hire as security at a screening at a regular movie theater.
Yes, yes.
Those guys are unbearable sometimes. Like, they have made up all sorts of things in their head about how the world is supposed to work, and then they just lay it on you. Like, and now you allow me to strip search you. And I'm like, no, that is not what's going to happen. Yeah. Studio lot security dudes, they're generally almost always, I don't think I've ever had a bad encounter with them.
Also this week, Ruby Sparks.
It's fine. It's fine.
It's...
I liked it more than you did.
You did, yeah. The premise is basically Paul Dano stars as a blocked novelist. And 10 years ago, at the age of 19, he wrote what many consider to be like the great American novel. And since then has not really produced much of anything. And as an exercise suggested by his therapist, Elliot Gould, he starts writing about this girl who appears in his dreams... named Ruby Sparks, and before he knows it, she exists and is living in his apartment. And so, at first, everything is awesome, and then she sort of starts becoming her own person, and he has to figure out if, you know, he can love her as herself, or if he has to keep rewriting her to be what he thinks his ideal girl is. Which is a cool premise, and I think it would be a great short film. But I don't think there's enough here to make a movie. It feels really slight to me, and I think it's a little overly enamored with its own cuteness. And I don't know, it all kind of wore thin for me after a while. And Zoe Kazan, who wrote the film and who plays Ruby, I don't know, there's something about her screen presence that I don't like, and I can't quite put my finger on it.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I mean, it's not like I don't find her actively distasteful, but I just didn't.
She'll be very happy to learn.
I know. Put that on the poster. Not actively, but I don't know. I didn't find her very appealing, and I just found the movie in general kind of not much of anything. I liked some of the supporting performances. I liked Chris Messina. I liked Annette Bening and Antonio Banderas. But
Annette Bening and Antonio Banderas were really great.
They were hilarious.
Like, I would like them to just be in their own movie.
Right. But yeah, I don't know, the whole, and then, like, there's this whole scene where, like, you know, we meet the ex-girlfriend of the Paul Dano character, and she, like, catalogs all of his faults as though, like, we hadn't picked that up from everything that had happened in the movie up until that point, and that really kind of, like, I hate when movies feel like you aren't paying enough attention, so they have to underline everything for you.
Yeah.
No, I'm in the minority on this one. I know it's got, like, 80-something on Rotten Tomatoes, and people are loving it. I was not down.
I am kind of feeling the opposite of you.
Okay.
I think that, well, first of all, here's where I will agree with you. Nose blower.
I did it away from the mic.
You did it away from the mic, and I thank you for that. Cinematically, it's not particularly compelling.
It's worth noting it's directed from the couple that gave us Little Miss Sunshine, their second film.
It's not a memorable, you know, visual experience.
Mm.
Other than that, it is, you know.
The house was great.
Well, the house is great because the guy plays a super successful novelist. Yeah. A But strictly speaking about the script and the characters, I felt like it was an attempt to turn the and this is the word we're all using now, the expression we're all using now, the manic pixie dream girl.
Right.
I think it was an exercise in turning that on its head.
By making her an actual dream girl.
By making her an actual literal dream girl, and then by upending that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I appreciated that. I was happy about that. And I think that the script went out of its way as much as it could in the confines of, within the confines of, we kind of have to make this satisfying for people at the end. We can't have it, you know, turn into a total bummer at the end. Within the confines of that, you know, I believe that it succeeded, and that the underlying ideas about how men control women, and about how you know, what constitutes authorship of a thing, those ideas I really appreciated. And so, and because I find both Paul Dano, whatever you say his last name, and Zoe Kazan appealing, I felt like they carried it through whatever sort of rough spots happened. Even the ending, which is a little...
Yeah, it's... here's the thing, like all the, just so much of it just reminded me of stuff I'd seen elsewhere and better, you know, kind of reminded me of Stranger Than Fiction, all the parts where Ruby is trying to sort of branch out and become her own person and have a life away from Calvin, yes. and he resents it, reminded me of like the last half of Annie Hall.
Right.
The ending reminded me of Xanadu. You know, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in this movie that just kind of feels like seen it. And you know, Kazan is, she's a legacy. You know, she is. Elia Kazan's granddaughter. She's Nicholas Kazan's daughter.
Right.
Her mother is Robin Swycord.
Right. So I think that she's talented and has, and this is a good, you know, first time out at bat. I'm pretty pleased with this.
This would be a first
in general.
This would be a good first script that you would read and go, well, this is promising, and then send it either back for massive rewrites or say, well, what else you got? But this so feels like a first script of somebody who is cobbling together so much stuff from other things that she's seen or read or heard that it ultimately just kind of feels like this magpie's nest of, you know, stolen, you know, shiny things. I don't know.
You're bothered by things that I didn't, that really didn't bother me.
I'm in the minority here, but it's
another thing I liked about it was the way it sort of walked that line between being a film that was about precious indie cuteness and indulged in precious indie cuteness.
Yeah, no kidding.
And if you have no tolerance for any of that, even as a rom-com that comments on that sort of thing, then you might ought to stay far away. We have some personal friends whose tolerance for that is at a like less than zero level, and so you know who you are, but in general, I was, you know, I think it's when we were talking last summer about the future.
Right.
And the idea of Miranda July sort of trafficking in a similar, much weirder
right.
version of this. The idea of what is that idea of girlish cuteness in indie film, and how do you dig deeper inside it, and how do you get past it? Especially if you are female and you're the creative force behind the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I
have a sore throat, or I would impersonate the cat.
I think that Zoe Kazan is somewhat less successful at it than Miranda July. You know how much I loved The Future.
Mm-hmm.
I did not. And I know you did not, yes. But I think that The Future goes off and is trying to do something entirely else.
Yeah, no, it's a more ambitious
movie. It's not a romantic comedy. It's a much more ambitious, strange film about failure, really.
Hmm.
And you know how much I love movies about failure.
I know you do.
So yeah, no. I'm generally fine with this pretty good movie.
Okay. A ringing endorsement from Dave White of Movies.
I kind
of
liked it. It's when Hollywood comes along and the idea of fixing it up so it's nice and clean at the end always kind of gets under my skin.
Yeah,
I'm not happy.
Yeah.
Generally, when that happens,
it's like,
and I'm in the minority. I understand that I'm completely in the minority. That to be the kind of person who wants messy endings or ambiguous endings or unhappy endings,
yeah,
or
people want yay.
Yeah, I know that makes me a freak on some level.
Like
I don't care. I'm the one with the podcast.
No, exactly. There you go. So there. I remember seeing Our Idiot Brother at Sundance and like having some problems with it, and then seeing it again, and they had tacked on this ludicrous happy ending. Then I was like, ugh, now it's even worse. Also this week, Step Up a Revolution.
That's right.
Which we're going to have to talk about the ending of, and we'll, when we get to that part, I will tell people, you know, just to give us 2 minutes, and they can fast forward if they don't want to hear that part.
Yeah, we'll time it.
Yes, but we haven't gotten there yet, so keep listening. This is the fourth in the Step Up franchise, and now we're in Miami, and there's this guy who's a waiter. And
no.
What?
No.
What?
You need to start where it starts.
Okay.
Because where it starts...
We're on Ocean
the
Drive.
Greatest 5 minutes of cinema of 2012. I'm not being funny. I'm not being funny. I'm not being ironic. I'm not being facetious. I'm not being goofy. I am saying that the first 5 minutes of Step Up Revolution is the greatest thing you will see in 2012.
I don't know that I'll go that far, but it's pretty great.
Yeah.
Okay, so we start on Ocean Drive.
And I've got the touring horse still in the back of my head here, okay?
Okay, okay.
All right, that's what I'm saying.
All right. We start on Miami Beach, South Beach's Ocean Drive, and there's a traffic jam, and suddenly...
But is it a traffic jam? Or is it the beginning of a jam?
Suddenly...
The latter.
A rainbow coalition of muscle cars with advanced hydraulic systems.
Oh, God, I want a car like that so badly.
Purple. Spews out.
So that I can drink a grape soda and it will match.
Spews out a bunch
while I'm driving around.
Of hip hop.
Wilshire.
Of hip hop dancers who do this big crazy flash mob. And they are the mob. And.
This is not just a dance. This is a flabbergasting display of insane acrobatic frippery. Like, this is the Moulin Rouge of booty popping,
car dancing,
car bouncing, people throwing themselves at you in 3D, by the way,
yeah.
Which, if you're going to see it,
oh yeah,
see it in the 3D.
The 3D in this one is much better than the 3D in Step Up 3D, which they did not exploit nearly enough. This movie, they really, you know, it ain't peanut, but still, they take it to some cool places.
Take your breath away.
It's a lot of fun to watch.
Me, Gray, Bibbs, I think the schmoes were sitting in front of us.
I wasn't there.
Bibbs
loves these
cheering.
Movies.
We were cheering.
here's my part from the ending, which we haven't gotten to yet. My beef with this movie is like what generally bugs me about dance movies is that they edit like crazy, so that literally like you and I could become the greatest dancers on earth for all we know, because you never see.
I'm already.
Yeah. Yes. You.
I'm already one of them.
Yes, because you never see anybody do a full like. Motion, a complete anything, because they're like cutting to another angle, cut, you know. This movie, the takes are longer, the camera stays still longer, but what the director does instead is all this post-production trickery where he either speeds up or slows down.
And it looks great.
The dancing, but it's distracting, because I just...
No, it's not distracting.
I want to see...
It's enhancing.
I want to see people dance in a dance movie. Is that crazy?
A little bit. You're old. I like it when they slow down and speed up.
once or twice maybe, but they do it in almost every number.
It's like they are a turntable, and this DJ is spinning them down, slowing them up and spinning them.
All right, fine. I'm old. Yeah. I like to see people dance in a dance movie. Meh, that's it.
They're dancing. Oh, do they dance?
They dance, but I want to see them dance unencumbered by, you know, After Effects.
That's okay. After Effects don't ruin anything in this film.
Whatever.
They just make it awesomer.
Anyway, the dance numbers in general, though, are pretty joyful and, like, crazy and elaborate and
that
fun.
That's the best word for it. They are joyful.
Yeah.
They're nuts.
Except for the one where they come out in gas masks, which is now sort of all touchy because of the Batman thing.
Well,
that's intended to be the angry dance number.
I saw it before the murders.
Uh-huh.
I saw the Step Up Revolution before the Colorado murders. Mm-hmm. And so obviously I wasn't thinking anything about it being menacing or foreboding or anything.
But no, it's intended to be. I mean, that's the one number that they even in the movie apologize for doing it later.
If anyone in real life were to be menaced by someone breaking in to choreograph a dance in front of you, then you're an idiot.
I'm not. Okay, you're not listening to me. I'm not saying.
I'm never listening to you.
I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the scene. I'm just saying that it's the one number in the film that's not joyous. It's not intended.
It's meant to be angry.
It's meant to be angry. It's meant to be dark.
But
that's what I'm.
But
saying.
It's still not.
No, it's fine. I'm just saying that's the one number that isn't joyous. And even if the Batman thing had ever happened, it would still not be joyous because that's how it's designed to be in the film.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You clod. Okay. We are now going to talk about the very... Let's explain the plot of this movie. Tell them what the plot is about. Okay, great. Explain the plot first. Sorry. Well, you keep interrupting me and
There's
changing the subject.
There's a big boss, and he's mean.
Okay. Our hero works as a waiter in a hotel. The hotel has just been bought by Peter Gallagher, who's the big, bad real estate developer. Peter Gallagher's daughter wants to be a dancer in this foofy dance company, but she's too white and uptight, and she needs some street rhythm in her soul.
Yes.
So she and the waiter hook up, and then she joins the mob, and then when she realizes that dad wants to tear down the stretch of water riverfront in Miami where the waiter and all of his cool friends and the Cuban nightclub are, she decides to tell them, she tells the mob they need to switch to protest art.
That's right.
And so they start messing with Peter Gallagher and like showing up at his events and doing these choreographed numbers that show what a big greed head he is. And then they win. And then they win, basically, yeah.
Which is not the spoiler we were getting to.
Yeah, no. Well, I'm trying to figure out what the compromise is going to be. Like, is it going to be one of those deals where Peter Gallagher builds a mixed-use thing, so they keep the Cuban nightclub, but then there will be, like, you know, all these condos on top of it now? Who knows?
They show him and all the other Richies what's what.
Right.
With dance.
Yes.
This is what he's supposed to do. The step-ups, they win. The step-ups win at the end. But that's not the spoiler.
Yes.
The spoiler is the reason.
Okay, wait. All right. We're going to start talking about the spoiler, and speed ahead. If you don't want to hear it, speed ahead to 2 minutes from now.
Yeah.
Okay, go. Explain.
After they win the battle of the development project. Some guy. Who is it even?
He's like the marketing guy who's working with Peter Gallagher.
Some guy comes up to them and says, you guys are so great and you've done such good work here that Nike wants to sign you to an endorsement deal. And the co-creator of the dance mob says, where do I sign?
Now, mind you, the mob.
Ta-da!
You know,
the end. That's the end of the movie.
And
is the last 30 seconds of the film.
For the entire film, they started out as just being like they wanted to be YouTube stars and like win some contests on YouTube for having the most hits. And then they get all politically rallied and it's all about sticking up for the underdog and fighting the man, da da da. And so then how do we cap off all that political involvement and
all that
protest
all that Occupy stuff?
Yeah. With signing with Nike. It's shocking. It is so appallingly wrong-headed. It's just like, what?
If you've already read my review for the film on movies.com, I do basically what we're doing now. I spoil at the end after an alert, but there'll be a spoiler. And as I say at the end, the phrase Nike sweatshop does not have its own Wikipedia page for nothing.
Exactly.
This is a corporation that has been dogged for, what, two decades, even longer now, yeah, about their labor practices
in the third world.
In the third world countries. And they still, 15 seconds. They still don't quite have their act together on
it. No, I don't think so.
That's my understanding,
yeah,
based on everything I read. And so, are we done? Is it the end of 2 minutes?
We have 5 seconds. It just feels like a betrayal, basically.
Okay, so.
And we're back.
Okay, now, that spoiler that we just talked about is the reason why I didn't give this the full 5 stars I would have given it.
Oh, my God.
Because it's a dumb movie, but it's as I say, it's post-dumb, in that dumb is irrelevant,
right,
to this film. It's about being wowed and the feeling of watching these people like just fly through the air.
Yeah.
But the thing that we just discussed as a spoiler made me split my star rating in half. You know I'm on record as not really loving
right
stars or A's, B's, C's,
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
But I had to do something. So in my heart, up until that final 30 seconds where the spoiler takes place, mm-hmm, and I mean literally the final 30 seconds of film.
Yeah.
I'd have been 5-star in this one. That's how happy it made me. That's how much fun I had. But the spoiler indicts the film as not being post-dumb, but actually dumb.
Yes.
Because if it weren't...
It doesn't understand the issues that it's addressing.
Right. It doesn't understand itself thanks to that spoiler.
Right.
And so I cut it in half.
So here's our suggestion.
2.5 stars.
Go see the movie. Leave the theater immediately after the big closing dance number. Then go back and listen to the 2 minutes. We'll tell you what you missed.
Specifically when to leave is after the big dance number. And everyone gets converted to their way of thinking.
Yeah.
And the mayor is popping and locking. The right mayor is the dancing.
Miami, yes.
And then they're done, and everyone hugs, a big group hug.
Mm-hmm. Get out.
Run out of the theater. Before anyone says anything,
yes,
leave the theater. And then you will have seen an amazing, wonderful, silly, dumb movie.
Right.
And you will have had a great time. And in 3D.
And if you're a fan of the Stephen Boyd, Charlton Heston, unspoken gay subtext in Ben-Hur, wait till you get a load of the waiter's best friend who gets very resentful when Peter Gallagher's daughter starts coming around. That's all I'm saying. There's two more movies this week, one of which only you've seen and one of which only I've seen. So you go first.
Can we talk about other things about Step Up that we like?
Oh, yeah.
I liked it when...
I liked how the DJ never had speakers.
She was great. Notice she had little speakers. Didn't you ever see them? She had these little speakers.
Well, but she had that somehow magically filled these enormous spaces.
Filled a boom of a room, yeah. Yeah, I love the DJ. I love the silent graffiti dude.
Right.
Who would construct elaborate graffiti art within the confines of like a 2-minute dance number.
Yeah.
I liked when the girl finally says about the protest art, like, it's time for protest art. Because you wanted her to be saying, like, I have recently been reading Das Kapital. And now I believe in socialism. And I'm tired of...
It's time to smash the bourgeoisie.
I'm tired of these complicated structures of privilege that have been keeping us all down. I'm tired of multinational corporations screwing us under their thumbs. You know, like, I wanted a bigger speech from her. I know it was
not the kind of movie. She's still Peter Gallagher's daughter.
I know, it's not the kind of movie, but I was really I was imagining all sorts of other dialogue for her.
I liked the scene where the waiter and Peter Gallagher's daughter do the salsa, because it's the one dance number the director does not, like, mess with. He lets it just dancing happens.
I liked that Michelle Tuzzi from local Los Angeles News is in the movie and has dialogue. Like, she's talking about, and the mob is really taking the world by storm.
Oh, right.
And I was
right.
Like, it's Michelle Tuzzi. Like, and you don't know who she is if you don't live here in LA, but she's like a local anchor woman. And it's just funny that she was in the film.
And I like that Moose comes back.
I like in general, you know, the film's approach to human behavior is really not about real, you know, humans at all. It's this... You gonna sneeze again? Go ahead, do it.
I
Did I talk you out of it?
You talked me out of it.
Awesome. I like how it's sort of an abstraction on real human behavior.
What, like you mean how waiters can all afford muscle cars and
everything about fedoras it is and suits this weird and fantasy land and you know, I like the big number at the end, you know, isn't really about anything.
No.
Like it's just an interruption to the big, you know, ceremony. And I was kind of wanting for someone to be like, we call this dance Public Policy Initiative number 306. Like, I just wish that had been, you know, there would have been some context.
These long ribbons symbolize the bloodshed by, I know, that's, they don't really know.
Yeah. Such a good movie.
A missed opportunity.
Such a bad movie.
Yeah.
I'm very conflicted still to this moment. What I'm going to do from now on is pretend that the final 30 seconds don't exist.
Okay.
Because you can do anything you want now with watching films. You can watch it on your phone and then turn off your phone when you don't feel like watching anymore. And you have ended the film. That's kind of Godardian in a way. So just do that with this film. The end.
Okay. Why don't you tell us about Alps? Since I still haven't seen it and I don't know that I'm going to get to. Is it even still showing?
Well, here's the thing about Alps. I'm going to pull up the website.
Not to be confused with Homps.
I'm fixing to tell you about this Greek movie called Alps. Now, if you saw Dogtooth.
Nominated for an Academy Award.
Last year, which was nominated for an Oscar for the best foreign language film. This is by the same director, Yorgos, it's depending on how you spell his name. Mm-hmm. And there are different ways of spelling his name, depending on where you were at.
Because our alphabet is not the same.
Correct. Lentimos is his last name. Alps is an awesome movie that opened in New York on the 13th. And the reason my review did not go up on the 13th is because Movies.com did not even have a page for this film. That's how micro-release they are on this movie, okay?
Right.
And it's not Movies.com's fault. It's they handle big and medium big. And every once in a while, I throw a wrench in the system, and I'm like, I'm reviewing this film that's getting a micro-release, and it's going to play on one screen around the country for 46 weeks before it eventually hits DVD a year from now. But, like, it opened in New York on the 13th for a week at the Cinema Village. Mm-hmm. And also in Lake Worth, Florida. Those were the two places it opened on the 13th. Then it moved on where it is currently playing in Seattle. So if you're listening in Seattle, it's at the Grand Illusion Cinema right now. And it will be gone this Friday. So get out there.
Has it opened in LA yet?
No, and then it's going to go to the Memphis Brooks Museum of Art for one night in Memphis, Tennessee. Then to the Roxy in San Francisco. And then to the Texas Theater in Oak Cliff. Oh, no. It's apparently already in Oak Cliff.
Okay.
Texas. This is in Dallas.
Where Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested.
Right. Then Boston. Then Iowa City. IA, is that Indiana?
Iowa.
Or that's Iowa. Iowa City, Iowa. Columbus, Ohio. There's not even a Los Angeles release date for this yet. That is how...
We're no Iowa City.
That is how... Well, it's going to college towns and museums.
Right.
This is essentially the same release pattern that the Touring Horse had.
Right.
Like,
except the Touring Horse opened here.
Bit by bit, little by little, place by place. Mm. So you go... Here's how you find out after I tell you how awesome this is. You go to Kino, KINO.com, and you'll get the schedule of where it's going and what's happening.
Did you get a screener or something?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I emailed Kino because the publicist there has been the publicist there forever, and
he's great.
He's a good dude, and he always sends me stuff. And I was like, I got to review this movie, so can I get a copy? And he sent me one.
It's weird because Dogtooth was kind of like a mini hit. I mean, it was, you know, it got around.
Well, it was weird.
It got an Oscar nomination.
It's a sore thumb at the Oscars because of its...
Well, yeah, obviously because of its weirdness.
Because of its total, like, art filmness.
But, like, it played it... It was either... I think it was at Sundance or South by Southwest. I remember a lot of reviews out of that festival and people really loving it. And it played, you know, like, CineFamily played it. And I don't know. I'm kind of surprised this one's getting so tiny a thing. But anyway, it's out there. And track it down and tell us about it, Dave White.
It is about a group of people... A gymnast, her coach, a paramedic, and a nurse who form a secret group called Alps. And they explain why they're called Alps in the movie. And their job is to go into the lives of people who have recently lost a loved one and substitute themselves for the deceased. So, for example, in the movie, there is a young girl who a tennis champ who has died in a car accident. And the nurse goes and substitutes for her, lives in her room, says and does things that the daughter of the tennis champ would do to ease the suffering of her grieving parents.
But does somebody call them, or do they just show up?
They offer their services.
I see.
To the bereaved people, mm-hmm. And they do it in a way that is like, literally, she says, "The end can be a new and better beginning." It was like funny and creepy at the same time, and then the people like say, "Okay, sure, we'll let you do this," but they're not good actors. And they're always screwing up. And they fight amongst themselves. They become inappropriate with the people that they're subbing for. And it becomes this very sort of convoluted, like, role-playing drama of, you know, we are battling within our own little group, and we're screwing up other people's lives in the process, but we're a secret, so it's like we have to keep this all under wraps. It is a strange, strange film. And absolutely compelling. Absolutely, like, demands that you keep watching it because you want to know where they're going to go.
Well, because Dogtooth was also about this weird insular kind of...
It's about, Dogtooth is about a family where they hold their own children hostage and never let them go. And make them believe crazy things about the world.
Yeah.
They give things the wrong names. And, yeah. And tell their kids, you know, the airplane is really, you know, a stapler, you know, like this is, they mess with their children.
Right.
This is, similar in that they're this very strange, dysfunctional group of people who are providing an alternate reality, only this time for people who have, hired them.
Right.
To provide the alternate reality. And I love this movie. It's minimal and it's strange and it's moving in ways you're not expecting it to be moving, and it's sad, and you will not forget it when you see it. It's the kind of film you walk away from it going, what? What just happened? What are they doing? Like, every 5 minutes or so you're like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? And there's not always an answer as to, you know, why the people are doing the things they're doing. I loved it. And if you are of a mind to enjoy that sort of, you know, messing with you kind of film, please find it. Eventually what's going to happen here in L.A. is CineFamily is going to show it. They are the people who will show this.
I'm sure.
Or New Beverly, or, you know, it'll be one of those two places.
Right.
But, like, with the press notes.
Is that a glossary?
Yes. No, it's not a glossary. But I'm going to read you this page of the press notes. Here's, and there's no reason for this to be in the press notes. Absolutely no reason.
Okay.
It is a list of rules that the Alps members must abide by, written by the head of Alps, who goes by the codename Mont Blanc. Alps members, number one, must declare in advance the things they are unwilling to do, by filling out Form 1. Examples: kissing, lifting weights, traveling, etc. Number 2, must declare in advance the things they are good at by filling out Form 2. Examples: dancing, water skiing, discussing, etc. 3, must have some basic knowledge of psychology and sociology. 4, are obliged to support, under all circumstances, the interests of the Alps group. Number 5, must respect each other. Number 6, have the right to change their nickname only twice. They cannot choose a nickname belonging to another Alps member. The nickname must strictly be the name of a mountain in the Alps and not something general or irrelevant. For example, blonde, master, dragon, etc. 7, can never talk about Alps activities with non-Alps members. 8, are obliged to take the gymnastics club test if necessary. 9, must be over 14 years of age. 10, should always be smart, clean, punctual, and in complete control. 11, must never get emotionally involved with clients or have intimate relations with them. 12, cannot change their physical appearance without the leader's permission. For example, dye their hair, lose or gain weight, wear colored contact lenses. 13, must be able to make convincing facial expressions, sadness, happiness, despair, etc. 14, must honor the title of their membership and be ready to kill or die for it. 15, must never attack one another and must believe in teamwork. Okay, now here's the thing about this list. It is never read in the film.
The director just wrote that and threw it into the
press notes. This is the press notes. It's not read in the movie. Another reason to love this film.
Okay.
And this is the thing that you won't get if you just go see the movie.
Right.
You got a special bonus from Linoleum Night.
Oh, I'm sure everyone's thrilled about that. Okay.
Go see Alps. It's crazy.
Then the movie I saw this week that you have not seen is William Friedkin's latest movie, Killer Joe. Like Bug, it is a collaboration with playwright Tracy Letts and is based on Letts' play. It stars Matthew McConaughey as a Dallas cop who is also a contract killer. And he gets hired by Emil Hirsch to kill off his mother, Hirsch's mother, so that he can pay off a debt to some drug dealers. Emil Hirsch's dad is Thomas Hayden Church, who is okay with this deal. Church's girlfriend is Gina Gershon, who is as Gina Gershon as ever in this movie. And Hirsch's sister is played by Juno Temple. And because they can't afford to give McConaughey half the money up front, Juno Temple sort of becomes the retainer in this deal. It is grimy and noir-y and bizarre and funny and
awesome.
NC-17 and
NC-17.
And I liked it a lot. It's not perfect. There were a few things that didn't work for me. And
I like a good NC-17. I know that.
No, definitely. I didn't like it as much as Bug, but it's very well acted. It wasn't crazy about Emil Hirsch, but everybody else is really good. Matthew McConaughey is on a roll. I mean, like, he is, I think, really kind of finding his groove as far as playing these characters that are not lovable, and I think that's his strong suit, frankly. I was a little annoyed because it's set in Dallas but shot in New Orleans, and they don't make enough of an effort to make it look like Dallas. And you can just, I mean, if you spent any time in Dallas, you will know this is not Dallas. And they, which would be fine, except they mention that it's Dallas like every 5 minutes, and so I'm like, no, it's not. It's not. Don't lie to me. So they could have faked that better, I think. But there, you know, there's a big scene at the end, like in the kitchen, that is clearly like the reason they wrote this thing, where like everything gets crazy and it's all confrontational and it's very, very, very intense. But yeah, you will like it a lot, I think, Dave White.
Excellent.
So, and yeah.
It just opened in New York. It opens in LA on
this Friday. Yeah, and expands from there. Like Gina Gershon.
I missed all the press screenings, so I have to wait till it opens here.
Gina Gershon, literally, like her first appearance on film, she is naked from the waist down, and she is at, her crotch is at the level of Emil Hirsch's face as she is opening up the door to the trailer. And it's awesome. Like, okay! Gina Gershon, ladies and gentlemen. She's awesome.
She is awesome.
And it's a fun movie.
Saw her in the gas station one day.
Yes.
Wearing sunglasses.
Interviewed her for the Advocate cover. She was she was rad and told fun showgirl stories. My favorite being, she goes, yeah, you know, I had seen all of these other Verhoeven films. They were all dark and twisted. So I was, you know, the whole character as I had created it was, right. was really just kind of, you know, evil and messed up. And then I got to the set and I looked around and I went, oh, this is the film we're making. And I literally had one night to completely overhaul the character and turn it into what it needed to be for this movie.
But it was exactly the right
And character. She was totally right.
It was exactly
she
the right
is, character. She is Crystal Connors.
In fact, if she had been a Verhoeven character from another earlier film, it was, still would have been right.
Probably so, yes.
It still would have been right.
But her
but we don't need to get into a whole showgirls discussion because I have a lot of opinions about indeed. That.
But her instincts are dead on.
They do not jibe with the majority opinion. Anyway,
we won't talk about that.
Quick DVD recommendations, and then we'll read mail.
Yes.
All right. Be fast. 30 seconds. Go.
Singing in the Rain, 60th anniversary edition. There is a lovely new Blu-ray out, and in fact, there is a Blu-ray collector's edition that comes with a very nice, lavishly illustrated hardcover book and an umbrella. So, you know.
So it's useless.
Well, the book is nice, and the umbrella, you know, it's whatever, it's an umbrella. But
just keep that umbrella in the box.
You can buy the Blu-ray separately. You don't have
show
to buy
it to your friends.
You don't have to buy the umbrella. Box with the umbrella
it's a
in
Singing
it.
In the Rain umbrella.
But anyway, you know, there are not a lot of movies that are beloved by
what
your...
What are you going to do with that Singing in the Rain umbrella? Nothing. I'm going to keep it in the box.
There are not a lot of movies that are beloved by both your mom and the people that do the Sight and Sound poll every 10 years of the, right. of the greatest films ever made.
It is one of the greatest films ever
it
made.
It is one of the greatest films ever made. Definitely on one of my probably top three films of all time. Yeah. And so great movie, lovely new edition, check it out.
There's the girl you were listening to tonight.
That's the girl whose voice you love, Kathy Seldon.
We just got Perfect in the mail from Netflix.
Yes.
Pretty stoked about that. That's my DVD pick of the week.
Even though we haven't watched it yet.
John Travolta and Jamie Lee Curtis aerobics movie.
Yes.
1985. And I decided to put it at number one on the Netflix queue because we have just recently watched on TCM Heavenly Bodies.
The Canadian aerobics.
Canadian aerobics movie from 84, 5, or 6.
It was post-Perfect, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Whose plot, in fact, is very much like Step Up Revolution, in which there's a...
Greedy
real estate people want to take over the aerobics studio.
Right.
So they have...
Not unlike in Break-In, where the greedy real estate people want to take over the community center.
Real estate people are greedy.
Always. And or any Mickey and Judy movie where the greedy real estate people want to take over the old folks' home. Where the
so they have an aerobics off.
Yes.
Where
on live television.
On live television. An aerobics marathon.
In the Heavenly Bodies we're talking
on
about.
On live television. For the deed.
Right.
For pink slips.
Yeah.
And
we're dancing for pinks.
Yeah. And so that was on TCM Underground. If anybody knows who programs TCM Underground, please tell us who they are so that we can send them a cookie bouquet, because...
I know the guy who started TCM Underground.
Well, we're sending Facebook him a cookie friends. Bouquet, too, because TCM Underground...
They've been on fire
...is
lately.
The greatest, not just lately, since the get-go.
No, but, like...
The only thing I don't like about TCM Underground is the bumper with the guy with the dreadlocks.
Oh, and the, yeah.
Weed pasting something punk rock or anarchic on
right.
the... That's silly.
That's sort of, yeah.
That's silly in 1992-ish, but...
We love the Rick Pralinger shorts. We love that you showed Christmas Evil in June or July or whatever. Yeah. That you showed Houseu and Little Darlings
and Heavenly Bodies.
And Heavenly Bodies and Sorcerer. No, mm-hmm. no.
Stunt Rock.
Stunt Rock, thank you. And, TCM Underground. It's rad.
We love you. And I love the idea that some old person with insomnia
that has TCM on all the time.
Has TCM on all the time. Basically, my mom is going to wake up in the middle of the night and be like, "Oh, what's on TCM?"
Maybe there's a Loretta Young movie,
and it's going to be Houseu. You know, so that's fantastic.
Yes.
Okay, letters. This is from Dan. Dear Dave and Alonzo, you'll note that he put my name first.
Oh, shut up.
in accordance with the contest that I won once upon a time.
Who is
the greatest on
Linoleum Knife? No, I put your name first when I do the listings for the show and when I do the show description as a favor, because I know that generally speaking, you are in my shadow. And so I try and give you a little boost so that you too can feel like a big boy and like you're an equal partner in this enterprise, even though I'm really the one steering this ship.
As the man who won the contest of who was the greatest,
you did not do any such thing because there was no.
That is why my name is first.
No.
Ever since you brought it up on Linoleum Knife, I've been haunted by notions of Parisian street food. I couldn't imagine a more spot-on summary of the experience. Well, that's why we're us.
Yes.
A few years ago, I had the good fortune to spend about 6 months working and studying in Paris. I went to cafes, museums, cathedrals, film festivals, lectures, you name it. I saw Claude Chabrol introduce a screening of Hitchcock's Lifeboat.
That's rad.
How rad would that be?
That would be pretty rad. Although we saw Charlton Heston introduce a screening of Soylent Green once.
We did.
And
he was great. was so great. It was the greatest 6 months ever. And still, if I talk to people about Paris, I usually go straight to, no, seriously, they stuff the fries in the heroes, so you can walk with it. It's true.
The euros. You said heroes.
Euros. I said euros.
You said heroes.
I mispronounced it the first time, and then I said euros. And then this guy was eating Nutella banana crepes right outside the theater. Nutella and bananas in the same crepe. Such is the Proustian mire you've thrown me into that I'm going to try making a croque monsieur this very evening in your honor for my dinner. However, it turns out I wanted to say thanks and right on. You've taken me back to happy, tasty times.
Bon appetit.
It is somewhat coincidental that we went to see Ruby Sparks this past, Monday night, Tuesday night?
No, you told this story last week. That's why he's bringing it up.
Oh, it was?
You told the crepe story and that's...
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm a dummy. Okay. Anyway, all right.
And we talked about Kevin Smith, so none of us remember anything. Yes. Yeah.
All right. So top tens. From Nayland.
Nayland Blake.
Nayland.
Internationally acclaimed artist.
Indeed.
And who came to my Christmas book reading.
Who's a great dude and a friend.
Yes.
And also a big famous artist.
And listens to this show.
Yeah. Hey guys, you know I love. He loves the podcast.
I do.
One love for you, one for me.
Nice.
I wanted to send it a top 10, but simply couldn't cut it down to that. These are, in no particular order, not only the movies that I love and go back to, but also the movies that I will watch the rest of whenever point I encounter them at. Flaming Creatures.
Have you ever seen Flaming Creatures?
Honestly, I have not seen Flaming Creatures.
I have not seen Flaming Creatures either. It's a big gap in
it's
my
a gap in both of
in
our
my, in my
our,
queer yeah. film education.
Yeah.
Jack Smith.
You're the man that probably should have already seen Flaming Creatures, author of 101 must-see films for gay men.
I know.
How did that not get into your book? What's your problem? Defend yourself. Stop. The people have a right to know.
You can't handle the truth. I haven't seen it. I need to see it. I don't know that it's a feature anyway. I think it's like 40 minutes or something.
Oh, is that how you're going to back?
That's
how you're going to back out that door?
And I'm sticking to it. Go on. What else?
Desperate Living.
Great.
Yep. My Man Godfrey. Oh, yes. Also rad. We saw that at the Hammer. We saw Midnight.
No, sorry. Midnight, no. But My Man Godfrey.
We saw My Man Godfrey at the New Beverly.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
I'm assuming that Nayland means the original and not the remake with June Allison and David Niven. I'm going to give him that benefit of the doubt.
Probably.
I think so, yes.
Yeah. Night of the Living Dead.
Sure.
Spirited Away.
Oh, yes.
The Incredibles.
Yes.
Yes. Careful.
Ooh, yes.
Yes, yes.
Early Guy Madden.
That's an awesome, that may be one of my, that may be my favorite.
Guy Madden?
I think so, yeah. Mm. That or Saddest Music in the World. Like, those two really are the two I go back to.
Well, assuming we can't count Heart of the World.
Heart of the World is like an 8-minute short.
You know, I kind of love Twilight of the Ice Nymphs.
Well, yes, I love Twilight of the Ice Nymphs too, but I honestly believe that...
It's very different from his other stuff.
That your and my experience with Twilight of the Ice Nymphs, seeing it how we saw it,
mm.
I think that really colored our perception.
Eating Shelley Duvall's popcorn?
Yes, yeah. Because Shelley Duvall was there.
Yes.
And she was early.
Yes.
And so because I was there with you as the film festival artistic director, I was there early too. And so I'm sitting there in the theater just reading a book, minding my own business. All the lights are up. There's no one in the theater yet. The audience has not even begun to show up yet. And it's a special screening for the USA Film Festival in Dallas in what year? 1998?
Something 99? Like that. Yeah, it was part of our independent showcase series.
Shelley Duvall is in Twilight of the Ice Nymphs, and she walks in with her mom. And she has a big bucket of popcorn, and she sits down about three seats away from me, and she goes, "Want some popcorn?" And I was like, "Shelley Duvall is offering me popcorn right now." Of course I said yes to Shelley Duvall, and I began eating popcorn with Shelley Duvall.
So you have now eaten with two members of the Nashville cast.
Yes, you're right. I have never thought about that. Yeah.
We had dinner with
Ronnie Blakely one night, and not privately. It was in the context of a dinner party that was thrown by a friend who was very close with her.
Yes.
So, yeah, but, like, I just sat there and had a nice little chat and ate popcorn with Shelley Duvall, and it was free popcorn, thanks to Shelley Duvall, who is maybe the sweetest, nicest, like, just genuinely cool person.
She's done several things when I was doing the USA Film Festival, because she lived in Texas, and she would come up for stuff, and she was always gracious, a delight.
When the audience did not like the movie, because it was Dallas, and there was some folks there that were...
They were not having it.
Older members of the film festival membership group that were not having the film on any level, and when there was a Q&A after, and they said to her, "Were you guys all on drugs when you made this movie?" And she just said, "No, of course not." I was like, I remember applauding.
Yes. I mean, I know there were some tabloid stories about her a couple of years ago kind of flipping out, and I'm hoping whatever that was. Yeah.
I don't remember any of that.
Yeah. I'm hoping whatever that was an episode that she got through and that she's fine.
I'm sure it was.
Because she's so great. I love her.
So yes, Nayland, careful.
What I was going to say, the other thing that makes it so different from Guy Madden, apart from Popcorn with Shelley Duvall, I mean, is that his only film that's in color?
Saddest Music in the World is in color.
Is it?
Yeah.
That's a film I think of as being in black and white.
Well,
even if it was in color, it's pretty monochromatic. I mean, Twilight of the Ice Nymphs was in color.
They all act like...
Anyway, okay, sorry, go on. More of Nayland's list. We're off on a tangent here.
Alien.
Sure, yes.
Nashville, who we just discussed.
Greatest.
Lady from Shanghai.
Sure, great.
Scorpio Rising.
Kenneth Anger.
All About Eve.
Love it.
Paper Moon.
Definitely.
And then he's got something on here called La Region Central, and I'm curious as to what...
Is it Central Station?
Is
he being all fancy and
giving? Being stupid? Like, I think we might be being stupid.
Maybe. Well, do you pull up IMDb? I thought you were going to do this before the show.
Well, I didn't do it before the show, but I will. While you are reading the next list.
Okay. All right. We'll give Nayland his knife score momentarily. And to continue our tradition that we're now trying to read more lists from women. Vanessa writes in.
No, we're not on an affirmative action thing about this. But we are reading letters as they come in, and we have never been, you know, intentionally not reading lists from women.
I'm just saying, we weren't getting them. Now we're getting some more of them, so we're able to do it. This was received in the last week since we started asking more women listeners to write in. She even signs it Vanessa Female in parentheses.
Did she really?
Yes. So Vanessa writes in, "I tried and tried, but could not narrow down my list to only 10 favorites. This is a bit of a cop-out. It is the 10 movies that consistently make me happy on repeated viewings, though not necessarily comedies. Number one, The Lady Eve.
I'm looking up La Region
Central. Oh, okay, sorry. Lady Eve, we love it.
You make a comment.
We saw it at the cemetery one time. Great Preston Sturges comedy. 24-Hour Party People. Steve Coogan, Michael Winterbottom doing the... What's that guy's name? Who's he playing? the guy who discovered New Order.
Again, you're talking to me, and I'm trying to look things up on the internet. You are incompetent. You are alone right now.
All right.
I do not exist. I am investigating.
Dave White cannot multitask to save his life. Anyway, 24-Hour Party People. Yes, terrific movie. Young Frankenstein, hilarious. That's one of those movies that I remember, like, my dad cracking up when we watched that movie. And my dad, you know, had a good sense of humor, but, like, not a lot of movies would really make him laugh a lot. But I just remember him sobbing, like, every time they would do the horse sound effect for Frau Blücher in Young Frankenstein. Number four, The African Queen. Sure, great. Number five, Raising Arizona. Probably maybe still my favorite Coen Brothers movie, or up there at least. I'm not sure, but I love that one. Six, Hot Fuzz. Not my favorite. I think it could be half an hour shorter. And somebody actually said, oh, well, it's too long because, you know, the movies that it's parodying are also too long. I'm like, that's a generous stretch, I think. Number seven, Rear Window. Yes, absolutely. Number eight, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. A movie I could watch every day for the rest of my life, I think. Not only the first Almodovar movie I ever saw, but I saw it in Madrid with no subtitles, and I was very proud of myself except for not knowing the word for eye drops. I pretty much got through the whole thing. Number nine, Lost in Translation. Yes, lovely movie. And number 10, Monty Python's The Life of Brian. Not my favorite Monty Python movie, but definitely funny, and there's a lot of good stuff in it. I think I prefer Holy Grail or Meaning of Life, but Life of Brian is definitely great. She also says, last week's mention of the 1995 Persuasion made me so happy. I love that movie. Give me the knives. Well, you know, I'm not going to go with Hot Fuzz, but I'm going to say otherwise, Vanessa.
Okay, I'm back, and I love Hot Fuzz, and I don't care how long it is, and you're wrong, Lonzo.
No, I'm not. So I give Vanessa a 90% knife.
Wait, my turn. I'm checking this out real fast here. No, Vanessa, you are 100% knife.
So there you go.
Case closed. 100%. I says so. All right.
Which means nothing.
I would like to announce that you and I are both idiots.
Oh, what is La Région Syndrome?
Normally, it's just me that's being an idiot. Although, I'm feeling especially idiot because also normally I'm the one that tells you about stuff like this.
Oh, is this some really obscure arty thing?
Yes.
That you were supposed to know about?
That I was supposed to know about. But I did not. But I am so grateful right now to Nayland because what I've just read about this film.
Uh-huh.
La Région Centrale, which is a French.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I'm sure I butchered that French, but...
So I don't get to make my Fernando Montenegro joke.
I can't wait to go find this thing, because here's what I've just read about this film. A 1971 experimental Canadian film directed by Michael Snow. The film is 180 minutes long and was shot in the Canadian mountains in Quebec over a period of 24 hours. Using a robotic arm and consists entirely of pre-programmed movements. The robotic arm never moves in exactly the same way twice, so that each camera movement is slightly different. Entirely shot, here's another explanation. Entirely shot using a robotized camera set on the top of a mountain in the Canadian wilderness in winter. The camera was mounted on a mechanical arm that could move in any direction, even upside down. Using instructions recorded on magnetic tape, the filmmakers could control the arm's movement, creating short routines that had to be checked and programmed daily. During the entire movie, the only sounds heard are mechanical blips and electronic noises synchronized with the camera movement. In an interview, Michael Snow said that his aim was to show the kind of images that an alien probe landed on Earth would report back home. I cannot wait for the opportunity to see this film.
So it's just footage of snow?
Probably.
Okay.
1971, and it's not on Netflix. I have a mission.
Is it on DVD?
Not that I can find.
Hmm.
And thank you, Nayland Blake, because I should have known about this already. But now I do, and now I'm extremely excited. Because this sounds exactly like as Aaron was saying to me this past week when I told him about Ruby Sparks. Here's why I love our friend Aaron. I'm standing there in Amoeba with him, talking to him, and I'm telling him about Ruby Sparks. And he goes, what's Ruby Sparks? And I tell him about Ruby Sparks. And he looks at me and he says, that sounds like just the kind of film I'm looking for. Meaning, I will never watch that film. But in all honesty, with all of my heart and sincerity, I will say right now that this sounds like just the kind of film I'm looking for, and I mean it.
No, I know you do. I do not...
You're going to watch it with me.
I will watch it with you. I do not summon the kind of enthusiasm that you do over this kind of
sounds,
film.
This sounds perfect.
But I will give it a shot, notably because it's being recommended by Nalen.
I have a new grail to hunt down.
So Nalen gave us 14 films.
You are 140% knife.
Exactly.
Even though we've never seen Flaming Creatures.
Right. But we know we're supposed to.
We knew it existed.
Yes. And we know it's important. We just haven't seen it.
And this one.
Yeah, it's a new one on us. We did not know about La Région Centrale.
I would like to encourage everybody out there who likes, you know, stuff like what I just described. Maybe there's other stuff we don't know about. Please send us your lists of freaky stuff.
Okay.
In addition to your top tens.
Like super obscure.
Yeah, because we can't just be giving you guys recommendations all the time.
Yeah, tell us.
Give us. This has been the longest
we've ever crazy done. Long, yes.
How long have we
gone? We're at 94 minutes.
All right, we got to go.
So let's wrap this up. We got to be done. All right, as always, we thank you for listening. We point you to our friends, The Comedy Couch, with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli, The Popcorn Mafia, Adios Blowhard, whatever Malcolm's doing next, we'll add that to the list. Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Throwing Shade, Team Jack, The Schmoes Know, The B-Movies Podcast, Film Spotting SVU, Pod Crash with That Chris Gore, Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can listen to us and subscribe on iTunes, and if you'd like to leave us a review there, that would be super swell, and we would appreciate it. You can listen to us on Stitcher Radio at thelounge.com. You can like our page on Facebook, follow us at Twitter, at LinoleumCast. Check into the show on getglue.com. You can contact us with recommendations, top 10 lists, questions, comments, whatever you want, at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And Dave is out of town next week. I'm going to have an awesome guest.
Yeah, I'm going to Texas.
And I'm sure next week.
I'm going to eat at my favorite Tea Party-owned barbecue place.
Woo! And I'm sure next week's show will be shorter.
I mean, the Tea Party doesn't own this barbecue place.
But the owners are.
But the owner is super Tea Party dude.
Right.
And I really love... I know it's kind of like, I guess, the equivalent of eating a Chick-fil-A, but I just don't care. This place has amazing ribs, and I really get a thrill out of being inside this place with all the crazy things on the wall.
To read the news clippings.
To read the news clippings on the walls and the anti-Obama videos that they have playing on the TV screen in the place.
It's like when
it's
you went,
insane.
It's like when you went for that delicious haircut in Atlanta that time.
That was great, too.
Crazy. All right. Catch you next time, folks. Bye.
Bye.